pray for greater liberty for our provision and our protection.
Terrorism, terrorism, chemical attacks, dirty bombs, fallout, biological attack, anthrax, and to top it all off, duct tape and plastic. Alarming words for our time. But how do you protect your family during such a crisis? The video Sheltering in Place, Surviving Acts of Terrorism from Biological, Chemical, and Radioactive Fallout was developed by Wayne LeBaron, a health physicist who has served as a specialist in environmental health, communicable diseases, and has worked as a nuclear specialist for the U.S. government. Anyone can follow the simple instructions. It's presented by a housewife as they walk you step-by-step through the process of preparing your home as a shelter. If you're not the type who waits till it's too late, then you need the video Sheltering in Place. Get the critical information you need now for only $29 plus shipping by calling New Millennium at 888-803-4438 and tell them Alex Jones sent you. That's 888-803-4438 or order on the web at murkywater.com.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station. There are my views. And certainly this afternoon, they're going to be the views of Robert Joling. And, of course, we're going to be talking about a book that he co-authored called An Open and Shut Case. That's an open and shut case. Now, Mr. Joling, are you there?
Yes, I am here.
Well, I thank you so much for coming with us, and I thank you so much for spending so much of your life. What have you done? How long have you been investigating the murder of Bobby Kennedy?
Oh, 39 and a half years.
All right. Almost 40 years then.
Yes.
And, of course, you've really done the definitive work on it, and you and your co-author of this book, An Open and Shut Case, and when will that be readily available for people?
Well, at the present time, we have the author's preview, pre-publication printed out, and we only have a very limited number of those books. We sent them out to people who reviewed it for us to make sure that it met the criteria that would be expected in forensic sciences, and to make sure that people who read it understood it and that they appreciated the work that was done. So far, we've had nothing but accolades, and we're happy about that.
All right. Now, you state in your book that Saran did not shoot Senator Kennedy on the evening of June 5th, 1968. So basically, that's a pretty strong statement. I mean, most people believe that Saran, who's been in prison now for almost 40 years, was the very obvious assassin. But, of course, there's a question, and certainly you've raised many, many questions in your book, and that's why your book is really so important, because if Saran did not shoot Bobby Kennedy, then who did, and why has the truth not come out?
Well, you have to start with the proposition that we're not trying to exonerate Saran from what he did do. He did fire his gun. He did hit three people, Paul Schrade being the first one, Elizabeth Evans being another one, and Erwin Stroh being a third person. However, he did not shoot Senator Kennedy. He not only did not shoot him, he could not have shot him because he was not in a position to do so. And that makes the story a very interesting one.
And, of course, I think the reason is, of course, that isn't it that the bullet that killed Senator Kennedy actually came from behind and to the right, and
yes.
Saran was standing in the front?
Yes, Saran was facing towards Senator Kennedy. Between Saran and Senator Kennedy stood the maitre d' of the hotel, Carl Euchre. To Euchre's immediate right was Edward Menasian, another maitre d' from the hotel, and another fellow by the name of Lubick. Now, the pathway that Senator Kennedy had to go through in order to go from the back of the stage where he'd given his victory speech to the Colonial Room where he was going to meet the print media, was a passageway of about 6'3". Now, you can't put three people, 5'11", weighing 185 pounds, side by side in 6'3" and expect the fourth person to get through them coming from the other direction. And so when Sirhan came towards Senator Kennedy, he came off of a tray stacker that had been at the end of ice machines on the right as Kennedy was proceeding towards the east. And as he came off that tray stacker, he ran to his right and came up against three steam tables, and his pathway was blocked by Carl Uecker. He pulled his gun, and he fired it twice directly in front of Carl Uecker, that is right by his nose, in the direction of Sirhan. And at the time when he finished firing a second shot, Carl Uecker grabbed the gun hand of Sirhan and bent him in a hammerlock onto the top of the steam tables, a position from which Sirhan never again was allowed to remove himself, and he was removed by the police when he did get off the steam table.
Mr. Jolie, please hold that. We just brought some new stations on board here.
Surely.
Because I wanted to introduce you to our listeners. Our guest today is Mr. Robert Joling. He's an attorney, and for almost 40 years he's been studying the assassination, the murder of Bobby Kennedy. And he's recently written a book called The Open and Shut Case. He co-authored the book. And it is a fascinating book with fascinating facts in it because, of course, Mr. Joling and his associate have actually spoken to many of the people who were there, and he can give you a moment-by-moment analysis of what happened. And the conclusion is, of course, that there was no way that Sirhan has been sent to prison for the murder of Senator Kennedy. There is no way, of course, he could have fired the shot that killed Kennedy. And so, basically, Mr. Joling was telling us that there were three people standing in front of Senator Kennedy, and, of course, Sirhan tries to get through them. He begins to shoot. But, of course, apparently most of his bullets hit other people, and he did hit a number of people. I'm going to let you tell the story here because I think it's so fascinating. And so we'd gotten to the point where actually somebody had grabbed Sirhan, had grabbed his wrist, is forcing him down on the steam table, and he continues shooting, but most of his bullets, none of his bullets really hit the senator, did they?
None of them hit the senator. What happened was that after he fired the first two shots, and Carl Uecker, the VDD, pressed him on top of the steam table, he kept on firing his gun. In the process, he did hit Erwin Stroll, and he did hit Elizabeth Evans. The first shot that he fired hit Paul Schrade, the union representative supporting Kennedy, in the forehead, and Paul fell down the floor unconscious. Now, as Sirhan fired his gun, naturally, all the people who were in the pantry at the time, which was maybe 12 or 15 people around Kennedy, and maybe a total of 25 to 30 or 35 people in the entire pantry, were mesmerized, and they all focused upon Sirhan, the area from which the bullets were being fired. At the same time, there was a person standing to the right and rear of Senator Kennedy who also pulled his gun, and according to an eyewitness, Donald Schulman, fired his gun three times and hit the senator all three times. That was a statement made immediately after the incident occurred, and the LAPD investigators just told him simply he was wrong. The interesting part of it was exactly that number of bullets struck Senator Kennedy. Another bullet went through the top of his right upper suit coat lining and into the ceiling above and behind Sirhan.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Mr. Robert Joling. Of course, Robert Joling has been studying this for almost 40 years, 39 and a half years. And as he points out, of course, there was a guard who was standing behind Bobby Kennedy who admits pulling his gun. And, of course, one person had actually seen him shoot Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Senator Kennedy. But, of course, the great tragedy of that is that the police insisted it wasn't true, that the man did not see what he said he saw, and Why would they have done that? I mean, you would think that they would certainly want to know if somebody else was involved in the assassination.
You have to realize, first of all, that no police personnel were in the Ambassador Hotel kitchen pantry at the time the shooting began. They came in after the shooting had occurred. The second thing you have to recall is that the shooting took place in 5.5 seconds. During that 5.5 seconds, the first two shots were fired by Sirhan. There was a pause. Euchre grabbed him, put him on top of the steam table. Then there was a flurry of shots. Altogether, there were at least 14 bullets fired at that moment.
But, of course, there was only 8 bullets in Sirhan's pistol, weren't there?
Yes, and that's a very interesting thing because afterwards, when the police officers got there, they confiscated no one's gun, not even Sirhan's. There were 3 guns that were known to have been drawn, and the police officers never confiscated a single gun. Rosie Greer, the football player, and Rayford Johnson, the decathlon champion, wrestled with Sirhan and taking the gun away. Rosie got the gun, handed it to Rayford. Rayford put it in his pocket, and it was several hours, at least 2 hours later, that Rayford Johnson delivered that gun to the Parker Station in Los Angeles. That's the first time the LAPD ever had Sirhan's gun in their possession.
Well, that doesn't sound like they did a very good job. You're supposed to secure a crime site.
That's correct, and they failed to do that. What's further interesting about this, although they were told by Donald Schuman that the guard had fired his gun, they never confiscated his gun. Although they were told that Jack Merritt, one of the other guards, pulled his gun, they didn't take his gun. They gave no polygraph test to these folks, and they did no nitrate test to see whether or not they had indeed fired any guns. And so they sat there with a gun with 8 empty shells, being Sirhan's gun, and declared to the world that Sirhan had fired 8 shots, and therefore there were only 8 shots shot in the pantry.
But, of course, basically the autopsy report done by Thomas Noguchi basically showed that the bullet that killed Senator Kennedy came from behind, whereas Sirhan was standing in front. Now, if you're standing in front of him, how could he have shot him from behind?
It was impossible, and that's exactly our premise. Now, in addition to that, you have to understand that when Tom Noguchi did his autopsy and wrote his autopsy protocol, he said that the fatal bullet struck the senator's head about 1 to 3 inches behind the right earlobe and about 1/4 inch away from the skull. Sirhan's gun never got that close to Senator Kennedy at any time during this entire period that the shooting went on. The closest anybody describes his weapon being to the senator is 1.5 feet, and it goes all the way out to 6 feet. So everybody who saw it and gave a statement has said that, except for the Los Angeles Police Department, who declared otherwise, even though they were not there.
Well, now, certainly, weren't the bullets that went into Senator Kennedy's clothing, weren't they fired from behind into the right as well?
Yes, every bullet that entered Senator Kennedy's body came from behind and to the right and went into his body at a steep angle upward. In addition to that, there were 2 bullets. One went to the buttocks of Ira Goldstein, and the other one to William Wiesel's belly. Those 3 bullets, the bullet from Wiesel, the one from Goldstein, and the one from Senator Kennedy's neck, were identified by firearms experts appointed by the court as having been fired from the same weapon. So all 3 of those bullets had to come from the same position.
But, of course, did they come from Sirhan's gun? Has that been, the ballistics been checked there?
They checked those. In 1975, those same experts checked Sirhan's gun with the alleged test-fired bullets by the Los Angeles Police Department criminalists, and from the victims that could not match a single bullet to Sirhan's gun.
Well, would make some people suspicious that if the bullets didn't come from Sirhan's gun or couldn't be matched, maybe Sirhan did not kill Bobby Kennedy.
Well, he didn't kill Bobby Kennedy, and it's not surprising to those of us who are in forensic sciences to find that a .22 caliber bullet cannot be identified as coming from a particular gun, because about conservatively 70% to 80% of all bullets fired through .22 caliber guns with a copper wash do not end up being identified as coming from that gun. So that wasn't too surprising. What was surprising, however, was that the criminalist who allegedly made the test claimed that he had fired the gun, claimed that he had been able to identify the bullets when seven other experts in the field could not do so. And that was a surprising thing to most of us. Secondly, there was a gun, it was H18602, an Ivor Johnson 22 caliber gun, that had been identified as being Sirhan's gun, and it was written on Exhibit 55 in the trial of Sirhan. It was in 1975, the same panel of experts found out that that gun was not Sirhan's gun. Sirhan's gun had an H5735 or something like that identification number. So the number was wrong, and then they claimed to say, well, that gun and the error was made by a clerk. In other words, a clerical error. Well, it could not have been because of the fact that the gun H1602 is identified as having been taken out of property on the 10th day of June, 1968, whereas the test firing was done on the 6th day of June, 1968. So everybody is wondering how in the world were they so clairvoyant as to know that on the 6th day of June they were going to go to property on the 10th day of June and get a gun with that number. It was very amazing. It said, where did this come from? Was it made up, or how did it happen, you see? Then, when the criminalist was examined about that gun, that was in 1975, he said it was recently dumped. That's the word he used. We went back and checked the records. That gun was indeed dumped, but it wasn't dumped in 1975 or shortly before. It had been dumped in July of 1968.
Now, what do you
before
mean?
The appeal of Sir had even expired.
Now, what do you mean by dumped?
Destroyed at sea.
I see. Okay.
And so that was a false statement, utterly incorrect at least. And then we pointed out the fact that the gun is identified by the LAPD as having been destroyed in July of 1968. That, too, became a clerical error. And we had a number of other things of that nature. During the course of their investigation, for example, they had a schematic drawing done. This schematic drawing was supposed to show where the bullets came from Sirhan's gun and where they went and where they ended up. One of those bullets is shown as going into the ceiling tile to the, Sirhan's position and the center's position, all towards the entryway that they came into. And that bullet came down from the ceiling, allegedly, and struck Elizabeth Evans in the head. The problem with that is that when you look at the hospital record of Elizabeth Evans, it shows that the bullet went upward in her head. You can't get a bullet coming from the ceiling downward, going upward in a head. So we investigated that. We found out that Elizabeth Evans had been bent over with the posterior portion of her anatomy facing the direction that Sirhan was at, and she was looking for a shoe which she had lost. And therefore, that bullet had to be one that came off the floor of the pantry and came up into her head going upward. Those are the types of things that were bothering us during the course of investigation.
But you know, certainly when Thomas Noguchi, who was the coroner at that time, pointed out that the bullet that actually pierced Senator Kennedy's head had come from behind, that the bullet that had entered his body had come from behind, Sirhan was standing in front, wasn't there anybody at that time who pointed out that this was impossible, that you just can't do that sort of thing?
Yes, but they simply ignored it. In fact, the authorities twisted Tom Noguchi's testimony and Huber's testimony to fit whatever was their ultimate end result and end story. That's what is so tragic and terrible about this investigation.
Well, now, my understanding is that the guard who admits to having drawn his gun and said that he got a powder from Sirhan's gun on his face, even though he's standing behind Bobby Kennedy, three or four feet away. How could that be? How could you get?
Yeah, if you visualize that for a moment, you have Bobby Kennedy with a guard standing behind and to his right. In front of Bobby Kennedy is Carl Euchre. In front of Carl Euchre is where Sirhan was. Now, Sirhan pointed his gun in the direction of Kennedy at that point. The powder blowback phenomenon would have caused that powder, as that gun, as the bullet exploded, to come out of the right and left sides of that Ivory Johnson 22 caliber gun and to blow back towards Sirhan, not towards the guard who is on the other side of Euclid, on the other side of Bobby Kennedy. However, if you understand that Kennedy was shot twice under his right armpit, once behind his ear, and once at the top of his right shoulder pad, you would then understand that somebody had to be standing very close to him in a position where it would be very difficult for anybody to see a gun in that man's hand if he was pushing it into the senator's side underneath his armpit.
But, of course, the fact that somebody actually saw the guard draw a gun and shoot the Senator Kennedy, and then the police said it didn't happen that way.
Yeah, they just told him he was wrong.
You have to begin to realize that somebody's not
and
telling
you. And then when you get to this powder blowback phenomenon, it's consistent with a second gun pointed in an easterly-northeast direction, in other words, towards Senator Kennedy, and that the powder debris exited the gun would be quite heavy coming on out the sides of his weapon.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here.
Great.
All right. Now, of course, has anybody actually had a chance to talk to the guard? Certainly was the guard questioned at the time. Was the guard's pistol confiscated to be so could be checked?
His revolver was that he had an H&R 22 caliber revolver, which he claimed that he had sold 3 months before the assassination. Theodore Chirac, who was an investigative journalist, tape recorded him on video stating that that he had indeed not sold the gun 3 months before, but 3 months later. In fact, Chirac showed him a receipt that he had obtained showing a Jim Yoder had paid the guard $15 for that gun. And now, interesting about that is that when you talk about the gun of the guard, its rifling characteristics are the same as the rifling characteristics of the gun that Sirhan had. Now, in 1975, that wasn't known. In 1975, they thought that the rifling characteristics of the H&R may have been different from that of the Ivory Johnson. But since that time, that's been corrected, and we now know that both guns have 0.054-inch rifling characteristics. So in that regard, they are identical. They are not, however, as we say in forensic sciences, they are not, those are family characteristics, familiar characteristics. To identify them, there must be striations that are left upon the bullets as they go out the gun, and those that should be matched one bullet to another to be able to say, yes, those two bullets identify with this gun.
All right, fine. Well, Chris, I think it's so very important now that... What about the guard? Has anybody talked to him to get his story of what happened?
Yes, he's been interviewed, not by us, and he's now in the Philippines. He divorced his first wife and is married and living out there. But there have been authors who have interviewed him. He has been interviewed by Teddy Chirac, as I mentioned. And interestingly, he was never... polygraphed by the Los Angeles Police Department, and when he was asked whether he wanted to be a witness at trial, he said he'd rather not, and they did not call him as a witness, and that becomes very interesting. They didn't look at his gun, they didn't give him a polygraph, they didn't give him a nitrate test, and they let him make his own choices of whether or not he wants to be a witness. And that's fascinating.
Well, it really is. Of course, has he explained what happened that evening? Does he admit that he drew his gun? And what does he say happened?
Yes, he does admit he drew his gun that night. He denies that he shot Bobby Kennedy, of course, but that's another story.
What does he admit at all that his gun discharged? Because certainly six bullets had to come from someplace. If there were 14 bullets, and certainly only eight.
His stories, the stories he's given have shown that he vacillates from one proposition to another, although he never admits shooting the gun. That's the one thing he has not done as far as I know. But nevertheless, he was the only person in the pantry that evening standing behind and to the right of Senator Kennedy who had a gun. The gun was loaded, and it was a 22 caliber. Now, there's another question that arose in our minds when we were looking at this. He was allegedly a guard brought in by Ace Guard Service, the first time ever on a job, but he was there for guard control. What in the world was he doing with a loaded gun for crowd control? We never could figure that out. What does a man need a loaded gun for if he's simply there to help in controlling the crowd and directing them where to go? And yet, even though he had the loaded gun, nobody confiscated it, nobody examined it, nobody compared any bullets
Hold that down. Well, this is Dr. Stan and Mr. Joling, who's been tracking the story of the murder of Bobby Kennedy, and he's been tracking the story for almost 40 years. And, of course, the guard who was standing behind Senator Kennedy admits he drew his gun, and, of course, he was standing in the right place to have shot the senator. But the police didn't confiscate his gun, didn't test him for nitrites. I said they didn't give him a lie detector test. They asked him if he'd like to appear at the trial as a witness. He said he'd just as soon not, so they didn't call him. And you have to ask yourself, what sort of law enforcement is this? Of course, they want you to believe it's an open and shut case. Saran, of course, shot, Senator Kennedy. That's all there is to it. And yet, of course, doesn't Saran say that he really doesn't remember what happened? It's almost as if he was under some sort of mind control. What's the background? What does Saran say about what happened?
Well, I talked to his mother at great length. I talked to Mary. She came to see me one time. I was testifying before the Los Angeles Board of Supervisors. And we spent a good half hour together, and during that time I questioned her a great deal about what her son thought and what his feelings were and what he did. And she said that he says he has no memory of shooting Senator Kennedy. He also states that, yes, he was by a girl that night, but when asked who the girl was, he doesn't know who it was. Now, there's been a story around for years about the girl in the polka dot dress, and there are some inquiries that have been made into that. And yet, Sirhan has also been known to be a person who was dealing in the occult and in the self-hypnosis. And there's a lot of authors who have written conspiratorial books saying that Sirhan was programmed to shoot Kennedy and then to forget. Now, Philip Van Fragg and I, as authors of this book, An Open and Shut Case, do not advocate for any conspiratorial stories. We don't denigrate them. We don't say they should not be followed, but we do not need that in order to prove our case. In our case, the physical facts show that there are at least 14 bullets that were fired. The forensic science engineering part, for the looking at the acoustics, shows that five shot sounds emanated from the position behind Senator Kennedy, and eight shot sounds emanated from the position of Sirhan. So on the oscillographic tracings, we can conclude that 13 shots were fired at that time, five from one direction and eight directly 180 degrees from a different direction, but all within that period of time. There weren't any others recorded because of after the 13th shot sound, there is a wild screaming going on from some lady who became very hysterical and drowned out any further audiographic recordings that we could look at.
Well, now, were there 13 bullets or 14 bullets fired? Do we know?
14 bullets were fired, 13 that we could trace on the oscillogram.
All right, fine. Well, now, Chris, you mentioned that the L.A. Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, destroyed evidence. What was that all about? Why would they be destroying evidence?
As I stated in the beginning, after Sirhan was placed down upon the steam table in a hammerlock by Carl Euchre, he kept firing his gun. And there were bullet holes in the center divider between the two doors that led from the hallway behind the stage into the pantry. There were two other bullet holes on the door jamb to the left, and a bullet hole in a door jamb behind the stage. So they had to account for five more bullets there. And the problem was, when you started out, you've got four bullets into Kennedy. Five other people got shot. Each person with a distinctly different bullet. That's five and four makes nine. You can't get nine shots out of an eight-shot revolver. That's impossible. He didn't have time to reload, because it all happened within 5.5 seconds. there were two double shots in the acoustical pattern, means two bullets were fired so close together they could not have been fired by a single person. It was like 129 milliseconds or something like that between two of the shots. So it could not have been shot by one person because it would take over 300 milliseconds to do that. So we knew that there were more bullets there than could ever come out of Sirhan's gun. Now, what happened was after they saw they had a dilemma and they couldn't account for the bullets in any other way, and they tried to have a simplistic method by saying, wait, eight bullet casings in Sirhan's gun, therefore there were only eight shots. That's true. There's eight. That makes that it. But there are more shots, so they just simply made those dissolve into thin air. However, they could never account for the two bullet holes in the center divider, the two bullet holes in the left door jamb, or the bullet hole behind the stage that was shown by Rossi and Wright in the AP photograph. So they made them disappear. In two ways they made them disappear. First of all, they just declared they weren't there. Secondly, they took the center divider, for example, and the other thing, they took them back to the police station, and they subjected those panels to explain.
Hold that thought for just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Robert Joling. Please go right ahead. You were telling us that they'd actually taken the center divider back to the police station, and what happened?
They took the center divider back to the police station and the ceiling tiles through which they claimed bullets had been fired. And when they got them back to the police station, they took x-ray examinations of these the evidence of the bullet holes. But then they destroyed the ceiling panels and they destroyed the center dividers. And they could never find the x-rays, and so they lost the whole thing. And they said, we don't have any evidence of anything, that they never did exist.
Well,
so they simply declared them out of existence. In addition to that, they destroyed over 2,400 photographs that had been taken, some of those by Scott Enyart, who got the beginning and last portion of his film back, but not the middle portion, which he claimed were pictures that he had taken of the senator being shot. And if that was true, that would be the only photographic evidence that existed. But then he had to sue them, and he got a $485,000 verdict against the city of Los Angeles for them destroying his film. So those things are just amazing that they would destroy the evidence before his right to appeal is gone.
Well, of course, you know, the thing is that anybody who watches television sees this program, Cold Case. And, you know, they will have in the box all of the evidence, you know, from a crime that was committed 30 or 40 years ago.
Absolutely.
And of course, the idea that the L.A. Police Department, the Los Angeles Police Department, would be that incompetent unintentionally, it's almost as if they were trying to cover up something.
I don't think it's fair, really, to castigate the LAPD entirely, not the entire force. This is the division of the criminalistic group that screwed it up. They're the people who had charge of the investigation, who failed to rope off the place to begin with, who had charge of gathering the information and the exhibits, and they had charge of destroying them. And unfortunately, whoever is the chief of police of the LAPD has to support their people, so whenever they're asked about it, whatever the story is they got from their criminalists, that's exactly what they parroted back to the public. So that doesn't mean that the entire LAPD is bad, it just means that this investigation was terrible.
And I think that really is very, very true, and unfortunately, sometimes when you're working for the police department, you get orders to do things, you go ahead and do them. Sometimes, if you know they're wrong, but you want to keep your job, your pension, your benefits, you better follow the line. And unfortunately, you can have a whole flock of wonderful police officers, but when you have corruption at the very top, why, of course, you'll never get the truth. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is Robert Joling. And he's written or co-authored a book called An Open and Shut Case. And we were simply told that Sirhan had suddenly shot Senator Kennedy. And that was it. It was an open and shut case. But, of course, Saran was not a very likable individual. He's Palestinian. And, of course, for some reason why they said, well, Bobby Kennedy supported Israel, therefore that's why Saran shot him. It's an open and shut case. And 40 years, almost 40 years has gone by. And, of course, so much of it's being brought out by Mr. Joling in his new book, An Open and Shut Case, points the fact that there's no way Saran could have done it. Now, that doesn't mean that Saran is not guilty of shooting several people and injure them, and there's not question that he tried to shoot Senator Kennedy. The only question is, was he under some sort of mind control at that time? And this is really sort of the impression you got talking to his mother, isn't it?
Yes, and most of the writers who have gone into the Robert Kennedy assassination affair have alleged that there is a conspiracy, and they say that Saran was hypnoprogrammed, and that is the problem. In one of the things they point out is in Saran's diary, you find the words DeSalvo. Now, DeSalvo was the Boston Strangler. The Boston Strangler was represented by F. Lee Bailey, a famous attorney. In addition to that, a fellow by the name of William Jennings Bryan III, who allegedly did some work for the CIA and did some work for the Psychiatric Association out in California, claimed that he had hypnotized DeSalvo and that he had hypnotized Saran. He had a couple of prostitutes that he kept in his care, and on one occasion when we went to Las Vegas, he was bragging about this. Now, whether that's true or not, whether the guy was just blowing smoke, who knows? But in our book, we don't go into it because, other than reporting it, because of the fact that it's not germane to our determinations or findings. In other words, we don't need to have a conspiracy to show that Saran didn't shoot Bobby Kennedy. He did shoot three other people, and whether people like it or not, he was guilty of an assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill. And if you take three people, if you only got 40 years for each one, it'd be 120 years. So it's foolish for us to even think that we would try to exonerate a person who did that type of a crime.
But, of course, if he was under hypnotic control, then perhaps he would not be really
yes.
responsible. But this is something that will have to be determined. Now, apparently there was a story as far as the guard's gun. You mentioned that he claimed he had sold the gun 3 months beforehand. Actually, he had sold it after the assassination. But what happened to that gun? Where is it now? And had they checked to find out if perhaps that is where the bullets came from that killed Senator
Kennedy?
I can
tell you a limited amount of information about that gun.
All right.
First of all, when the guard sold that gun to Jim Yoder from Arkansas, Jim Yoder had his house burglarized by some young boys who then, when they knew the cops were after them, threw the gun into a swamp. Through the efforts of certain individuals, that swamp was drained. The gun was found, and it did bear the same identifying serial number that Yoder claimed was the gun he purchased and had the receipt to show that he did. That gun then went down to somewhere in Texas, and from there it, I understand, came into the possession of certain individuals who are now attempting to see whether or not they can get the gun examined and whether a comparison of bullets can be made between the three known bullets that came from the weapon and see if they can get the match to that gun. Now, I can't tell you the person's name who's doing this or the department that's doing it, but I've been informed that that's what's going on at the present time.
All right. Now, in your book, you criticize the actions of the criminalists, Dr. Wayne Wolf, for the manner in which the investigation was handled. Do you blame the LAPD for the bungling of the investigation, Dwayne Wolf, or who was really responsible for not doing any of the logical things that you do in case of a
Dwayne Wolfer was in charge of it, therefore he has to be the one held responsible. And in fact, right during that same period of time, if you recall the Jack Kursky case came down by your Supreme Court, in which they said that Wolfer not only had falsified his credentials, but also that his testimony bordered on the perjurious. This is not the first time that he came up with a statement in front of a jury that this gun, to the exclusion of all other guns in the world, committed this act. And that's unfortunate, but that's, as Bill Harper, the criminalist in Pasadena, quipped, I guess is what you want to say. He said, Wolfer has permitted us to coin a word called Wolferism, which means that give the boss what the boss wants without regard to veracity. And Bill always used that. And apparently that has got some merit as far as this investigation is concerned as well.
Well, and of course, this really is so vitally important, because if they were able to cover up the murder of Robert Kennedy, what about some of the other murders that occurred at that time? His brother, the President of the United States, Martin Luther King.
Interesting question, because the other day on Good Morning America, I was asked that same question. Well, after 40 years, what difference does it make? Well, you know, there's over, the last count that I knew, 269 or 279 people who have been taken off a death row for crimes they did not commit simply because they could get the DNA testing of their blood and show that the people who had convicted these people were wrong. If they treat a case like Bobby Kennedy's in the manner in which we now know it was treated and convicted Suryan without even having the corpus delicti being able to be proven, how many more people are sitting in jail with this type of evidence? And that's the tragic thing about it. It's a question of restoring confidence and truth and veracity into our judicial system. And as long as we have people who are going into court and parroting falsehoods and improbabilities and then yet saying, I am an expert, therefore listen to me, we've got a real problem.
Well, now, who defended Suryan in court, and why?
Grant Cooper did, and Grant Cooper also failed him terribly.
And now, of course, you know, when he's Suryan standing in front and Bobby Kennedy shot from behind, the most logical thing would do would be to bring that up to the jury and say, look, it couldn't have happened that way.
Yes, except for one thing. Grant Cooper never investigated this case properly, and later on he said, had I known that I couldn't trust what Wolfer was saying, I would have brought in a firearms expert. Well, that's too late when the guy is, you know, out to jail for life. Or at that point, for murder, he's going to be convicted not only, but also be electrocuted for it. And it's nice to say, well, if I had known. You should have known, because if you had done your work right, you would have known.
But you would think that the case could be taken by some other attorney and appealed, pointing out the fact that Suryan was inadequately defended, and simply the fact that the bullets that killed the senator came from behind. That fact alone, that and the fact that there were 14 bullets fired, should be enough to reopen the case.
Well, there's another thing. You see, people ask us, what are you out for, a reinvestigation? We say, no. We don't want a reinvestigation. We want an investigation, a new one, based on the true facts, not something somebody concocts, not some evidence they make up, but what are the real facts, what is the real evidence, and what is shown by forensic science. And if they'll do that, Suryan may never get out of jail. I mean, I'm sure he probably never will. But at the same time, they could right a wrong and say, he's wrongfully convicted, but he's still guilty of X, Y, and Z, and therefore he remains where he's at. And if that came down, I don't think there's a person in the world could really argue about that. But then they also should go after the person who is still living and available and at least put him before a court and jury to see whether or not he is or is not guilty in the eyes of that court and jury of this crime.
Well, I think it's a fascinating amount of story and a fascinating amount of work that you've done. What sort of response are you getting? Are you getting on quite a number of the major networks programs?
Yes, we've been on, we've been on Good Morning America. We've been on CNN International. We've been over in London this past Tuesday. We've been in Hartford, Connecticut at a symposium where at the University of New Haven. We're scheduled for the Fraser Library in Louisville, Kentucky next month. We're scheduled to Duquesne University in Pittsburgh in October. We're scheduled to go into Los Angeles more than likely somewhere around June. And we're getting a tremendous amount of radio coverage on this.
Well, I'm certainly glad that you are, because, of course, we need to get the story out. We can never let this story go until the truth comes out, and it's quite obvious that there was another shooter, and he was the one who killed
him. Well, we haven't yet published this through a publisher, you see, and that's one of the things we're looking for, is a national publication who is interested enough to print the truth and the facts. And so that's one of the things we are in search for. What we did here is we printed a very limited number of books so that we could send them out to the people in our forensic science community to have a look at them and critique them to see whether or not we had done the right job and the right method and the right way. And we've had nothing but accolades so far. And although there are a few books yet we have, because we had 150 printed, we probably have 50 or 60 left or something like that. But if somebody wants them, they can go on www.anopenandshutcase.com, and there's a form there they can fill out and order the book if they wanted to. And when I say an open and shut case, it's spelled out all the way through. Even the word and is not an ampersand. It's spelled A-N-D.
All right, fine. An open and shut case, is that .org or .com?
.com.
And I've ordered it. I haven't had a chance to read it yet, but I did hear your excellent interview on Coast to Coast with George Norrie, and I thought
did.
Yes, and I thought it was an excellent.
We were sitting at a dinner table in Hartford, Connecticut, when he did that.
Right. Well, anyway, of course, I think it's so vitally important that the American people understand that most of what we're told by the media is not true, and this is simply another example of it. And the fact that you're not reading about this in your local newspaper, you have to ask yourself why. And why aren't we hearing about it on CBS 60 Minutes or something like that?
I think there's a simple answer to that. I have lectured at various colleges before, classes where they're teaching journalism. And what has happened in the last couple of decades, reporters are no longer going out and digging into the investigative ends of things. What they're doing is getting the word of some clerk in the judge's office or somebody at the courthouse, and then they go back and they parrot that to the public as it's told to them. Consequently, more often than not, they get the story wrong. And that's unfortunate. They are not as diligent, nor are they as, how would you say, hard-driving as they used to be back in the days of Walter Cronkite and those guys. They went out and worked. And I know one time Terry Drinkwater sat outside of a hotel room I was in for 8.5 hours trying to get a story. Who today would do that? And that's one of the problems we have. We don't have that due diligence going on in the investigative world.
Well, I said, have you talked to any people? What about Rosie Greer? Certainly, he was there. He was wrestling with Saran to get
the win. He wouldn't know too much about the actual affair, though, because he came in after the shooting had been done. He came in and helped subdue Sirhan and took the gun away from him. But at the time the shots were fired, he was in the back hall behind the stage.
I see. Okay. And then he gave the gun to one of his friends. And the police never asked for the gun. It was just turned in 3 hours later?
That's correct. They never confiscated the gun. They confiscated that one. They didn't confiscate the guard's gun. They didn't, or either one of the guard's guns, let me put it that way.
Well, did they seal the room? Did they try to keep the people there till they had a chance to talk to them?
Well, they claim that they interviewed thousands of people, you know, and they claim there were 77 witnesses in the pantry. Well, there weren't 77 witnesses in the pantry. There were very few people, like I said, maybe 12 to 15 in the immediate vicinity of Senator Kennedy when this started. And there were probably 35 people all told within the entire pantry area. And so there were very few people actually who were in a position to see. We know of 12 witnesses, whom we quote in our book, and their names are there, and the distances that they put the gun from Senator Kennedy's head are all delineated, so you can see what the people who did see it, what they said. And what they said is contrary to what the LAPD said, which is very interesting.
What do you think?
The LAPD not having been there, you understand.
Right. But why would the LAPD? Well, of course, we could certainly surmise that they were simply doing what they were told to do. And, of course, we could not let the
American. Well, not only that, you get to the point where if you've got a pompous director who is going to tell you what to do, you do it. And when he determines what it is and puts it down, who are you to contradict him?
Well, now, who did the investigation? Did the FBI do it? Did the local police?
Wayne Wolford did it. The FBI came in later, and in fact, Bill Bailey, one of the first FBI agents on the scene, examined the two bullet holes in the center divider and gave us an affidavit that they existed. And I talked to him personally years later, and there's no question in his mind that there were bullet holes in the door jamb. Except for the LAPD, they disappear.
And, of course, they simply accidentally destroy all the evidence, which is, makes you realize, of course, that this is not the way that police forces work, unless, of course, somebody is trying to cover up something. And, of course, you really don't conjecture who it was or why it was. All you try to do is just the facts.
Well, that's why the conspiracy buffs have so much fun, because so much is screwed up that it looks bad. You know, and maybe they're on to something. I do not know, but I wish them well, and I hope they're able to prove their case as concretely as we have already proven ours.
So basically what you've done is, yours is simply dealing with the facts, not surmising anything, not trying to conjecture if there was a conspiracy. All you're trying to prove is that Saran did not shoot Senator Kennedy. Somebody else shot him. Is that right?
Yes, and we did that on a factual and scientific basis, and nothing else.
Now, what about the sounds? You did was it the sillographs, or you had some sort of recording of what happened?
Well, Phil Van Praag, my co-author, went to the California State Archives about 5 years ago, I think, when we started on this. And he got the Pruszynski tape recording of the entire episode. It's the only known sound recording of this event. It was of very poor qualities, and when Phil got out there, what do I do here? And so he enhanced it, built his own copy machine in order to do it in the proper way. And in the process, came up with the finding that there were two different sound waves given off by two different guns, one being an H&R and the other one being an Ivor Johnson. Since these sound waves differ, he could distinguish where they were at the time that they were being shot. And then he and I went out to a firing range, and we test-fired guns, and we did some other things of that nature. And in the process, Phil made three discoveries. And
hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment here. You were just saying Phil made three discoveries with the after you had actually did some trial firing. So what were the discoveries?
Well, one was that you could show the actual fact that there was 13 bullets being fired. There are two double-shot episodes, and there were two bullets fired too close together to make it possible for any one person to have done that. And third, that the resonance emanated from one gun and the resonance emanating from another gun were able to be differed one from the other, so you could distinguish them. And that permitted us to locate the locations of the gun at the time they were fired. As a result of that, we were able to say not only does the forensic science acoustical engineering data show that there were two guns and that there were at least 13 shots fired. It shows that they were fired from two different directions and in opposing directions at the same time. And that substantiates the physical findings which I did through the forensic science data. And those two fit hand and glove so that one was wed to the other and substantiated one another. Now, Phil and I never knew each other until a year ago. A year ago, we both were asked to participate in the Discovery Times documentary. And at that time, we first met. That's when I first discovered that he was not a conspiracy buff, as I wasn't. And therefore, let's talk about this. And we did. And when we talked about what he had done and what I had done, and we saw how it fit together, that's when we decided to write the book. We started that book in July. We had it completed by November in its present form. We know that if we get a publisher, we're going to have to do some further honing of it, but at least we got this part to where we can absolutely prove that Sirhan did not shoot Senator Kennedy, nor could he have done so.
Well, if you can't get a large publisher, I do have a couple of smaller publishers. I'm sure I could get to publish your book for you. So you keep in touch, and we will, of course, be talking to you again, I think, next week or the week after that. And then,
I think we're scheduled for a week from next Tuesday. And at that time, I would like to suggest that you have my cohort with me.
All right, fine. We will. We'll be glad to.
I gave you his number and so forth.
No, I'll call you and get the number, but I was going to do that anyway. But we'll be glad to. We have a two-hour session.
Yes.
I think it's so vitally important, ladies and gentlemen, that you...
I think you'll find it interesting to see how he did this.
All right, fine. Well, I'm sure I will. But we're always learning something. That's the fascinating part of what I do. I get a chance to learn from other people what they've learned and get a chance to present.
Let me cue you in on one thing. The entire Los Angeles Police Department logger records for that night, those radio transmission records, those were kept in that 20-channel tape, you know?
Hold that tape just a moment. Well, Mr. Choling was just saying that the entire radio records for the night that Senator Kennedy was killed, what happened to them?
Phil was able to record those, and he had to construct a recording machine to do it. He did it in one swipe, and we have the entire record. As you can see, exactly the reaction of the police officers to this tragedy. That was a very interesting to read. We have the entire Serrano live box test that was given by Hank Hernandez. We have the entire autopsy protocol. We have every statement from the witnesses that we have used in our book. They're all in our appendices.
All right, fine. Well, we really look forward to our program week after next.
And
God bless you.
I read it by the time we meet again.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
All right, fine. Well, our guest has been Mr. Robert Choling. I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with him. Now, there's no question in my mind, having studied the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, that we've not been told the truth. There was another assassin, and Saran did not do it, but we can't let the American people know that. And then, of course, if you go into the background of the murder of President Kennedy, and, of course, we have 2 4 tape sets. One of them is an interview with Colonel Fletcher Prouty, who was the Pentagon liaison to the CIA, and, of course, he was immortalized in Oliver Stone's film JFK, because he was the one who told the district attorney in New Orleans to continue because he knew there was a conspiracy. And, of course, he understood. He had heard many of the people talking about the necessity of killing the President of the United States. So, certainly that is our JFK assassination, the first tape, and then the second four tape set is JFK update, where you'll have the interview with JFK's, I shouldn't say JFK, LBJ's mistress, who tells about the meeting the evening before when the plan for the murder was laid out. We carry a fascinating book called Elite Serial Killers. That's Elite Serial Killers. We have another book called A Sniper Looks at Dealey Plaza, written by our friend Craig Roberts. There's no question that John Fitzgerald Kennedy was assassinated by a conspiracy at the highest levels of our government, but we can't let the American people know that. And the same thing happened to Martin Luther King. And we do carry a book. It's entitled An Active State. It's written by Mr. Pepper, who represented Martin Luther King's family at the trial in 1999, where, of course, the charges were brought against the government. At least they were brought against Lloyd Jowers, and the jury found that the government was 70% responsible for the murder of Martin Luther King. You've never heard about the trial. Why? Because the media is controlled, and freedom of the press means if you control the press, you have the freedom to suppress anything you want to. We do have the book, An Active State, and we will have a four-tape set available on that within a few weeks if you want to order it. It's called Who Murdered Martin Luther King? And we have four interviews with people who know one or another aspect of what happened at that trial. You need to get the information. You need to understand that they're covering it up. They're covering up what happened at Oklahoma City. Did you know that Timothy McVeigh's sister, Jennifer, actually had a letter from Tim saying that he was part of a special forces team involved in illegal activity? Did you know that the man who shared the cell next to Timothy McVeigh in the federal prison said that Timothy McVeigh told him that Tim had told him he was part of a special forces team that was involved with illegal activity, and that the only way he was going to get out of prison was to be killed? the only way he was going to get out of prison was to be killed. We do have a tape somewhere by Bill Cooper. He used to do talk radio. He had a recording of a woman who had actually attended the execution of Timothy McVeigh. And she, in this radio interview, had said, "My goodness, I didn't know you kept breathing after you'd been executed. I didn't know you'd been continued breathing after you were dead." And Bill Cooper played that over and over and over again on his radio programs. You know what happened? Why, a SWAT team came out and killed him. It was supposedly he had killed a police officer. That's why it was done. But these things really do happen in America, like Gary Webb, who's written about the CIA and drugs, and he ended up killing himself by shooting himself in the head twice to make sure he was dead. Well, ladies and gentlemen, our number is 1-800-544-8927. And we'll be back on Monday. May the Lord be with you.